an honorary marauder. Quentin rode his horse for 2 hours, which did nothing to improve his mood, before heading back towards the stables. Despite the torrent of invective he'd received at the dinner table, he dreaded facing Solange the most, especially if she was crying rather than yelling at him. He dismounted and handed off the reins to the stable boy with a sigh, and with a loud bang, Harry Potter appeared 3 feet in front of him. The stable boy let out a shout of terror and promptly bolted back into the stables, but not without the horse. He was much more frightened of Quentin than a person appearing out of nowhere. "What in the hell are you doing?" Harry shouted and advanced on him, and Quentin, who was 9 inches taller and 60 pounds heavier, took a step backwards.
"Acting like an ass, obviously," he responded curtly. "I'm going to send them both owls and apologize."
"You do that," Harry hissed venomously. "Then you go and apologize to him in person. And why did you say you're not welcome here?" Quentin felt himself slammed up against a tree, which he found quite infuriating, especially since Harry hadn't even taken out his wand.
"So what?" he barked back when he could breathe again. "I've said worse shit to him than that, and he just blows it off. He knows I don't mean it. But I suppose you think no one can send you to Azkaban since you're the fucking famous poster boy."
Quentin thought later that that had probably been a bad choice of words. He found himself suspended at least 30 feet in the air, swinging upside down, obviously a rather unpleasant sensation.
"I thought Gryffindors were supposed to fight fair," he shouted down at Harry. "Do you think this is fair when you're using magic?"
Harry dropped him unceremoniously to the ground, and he stood up, rubbing his head.
"I suppose not," he replied sullenly. "I'm sure you think there's some side to your story. Remus doesn't get everything right."
This puzzled Quentin so much he didn't say a word.
"He never should have compared you to Severus Snape," Harry pronounced shortly. "You're not half the man he was."
He disapparated with another bang. September 6th.
"Can we stop by Weasley's Wizarding Wheezes?"
Timothy shouted happily as he danced along the cobblestone streets of Diagon Alley, his newly purchased bag of school books from Flourish and Blotts in one hand, and his robes from Madame Malkin's in the other.
"We still need to get your cauldron and your wand," Solange said worriedly as she tucked a stray piece of honey brown hair behind her ear. "And your owl."
"I'm bringing Charlie. You can only have one pet,"
Timothy replied stubbornly.
"Then how are you going to owl your mother?" Quentin asked him curtly, without bothering to mention Tim owling him.
It seemed rather unlikely, since he'd only spoken to his stepfather twice all summer.
"There's owls in the owlry for just that purpose," Timothy stated loftily. "Lupin told me."
Quentin frowned, and Solange hastily changed the subject.
"Let's go to have lunch at the Three Broomsticks," she broke in anxiously. "Then we'll go see George and get the rest of your stuff. What do you think?"
she asked Quentin, so he wouldn't think she was being too bossy.
"I really don't care," he replied irritably, and Timothy flipped him off behind his back.
"Hey, Tim!"
George grinned as they entered his store, where he was arranging a very noisy stack of caterwauling charms into a large metal bin.
"How are you?"
he asked Solange politely, but did not look at Quentin.
"We're fine,"
Solange replied and gave Quentin a worried glance.
"Off to Hogwarts, then,"
George said cheerfully as he straightened himself up and smiled at Tim.
"Yeah, I can't wait,"
Tim hollered, and George started laughing.
"That's brilliant," he replied amiably. "Hopefully you'll get into Gryffindor, and maybe," he paused dramatically, "if you're extremely mischievous and incredibly lucky, you'll get to be an honorary marauder, like me," he added smugly.
"Honestly?"
Tim shrieked.
"You think so? How'd you get to be one?"
"Sirius and Lupin made me one," George responded self-importantly. "They wrote it up on a parchment. Very official. It was when they were drunk at Grimmauld Place," he finished with a smirk.
"Impressive,"
Quentin said flatly, and Timothy glared at him. George ignored Quentin entirely and kept his gaze on Tim.
"It starts out as this treatise about Snape, but they sort of get distracted. Want to see it? I've got it in a frame in the back."
Timothy squealed with glee, and Quentin gave Solange a disgusted look.
"I want to see it," Solange announced defiantly. "Sirius was in the books, and I want to see something he wrote. It's historical."
"It's hysterical," George corrected her enthusiastically. "Come on back."
The parchment was actually a pair of 5-foot scrolls mounted behind glass in George's office, which Quinn couldn't help perusing with some curiosity. The surface of the escritoire was covered with a haphazard jumble of parchments, advertisement clippings, scribbled notes, pieces of candy, and an empty wrapper from a 10-minute fantasy charm. And the long shelf above it held a display of photographs in sterling silver frames. There were various pictures of his siblings, Percy being conspicuously absent, his parents, and the official Order of the Phoenix photograph, which Quentin resolutely ignored. The largest frame was an image of George and Fred in Egypt, grinning and poking at one another with sunburned faces. As soon as Quentin glanced at Fred, he glared at him and mouthed the words, "Fuck you," quite clearly. "Nice," Quentin thought to himself. "Even their pictures hate me." "Look, it isn't even faded. It's enchanted," George announced proudly and pointed at the scrolls. Messrs. Mooney and Padfoot, purveyors of magical mischief, valiant defenders of Gryffindor, warriors against evil, and drinkers of far too much fire whiskey, are proud to present
25 things Snape will not do before this bloody war's over. Apologize to Mooney for telling all the Slytherins he was a werewolf. Apologize to me for anything. Wash his bloody hair. Make a potion in reverse order, just to see how it turns out. Wear a set of pink robes and go dancing in the rain. Hang off his cloak without shaking the rain off on someone. Give a Slytherin a damn detention. Adopt Harry. Hand out non-poisonous candy at Halloween. Knit Albus a pair of socks for Christmas. Doodle on the chalkboard in class when he's bored. Tap dance on the table at an order meeting. Ask us if he can be an honorary marauder. Invest in Weasley's Wizarding Wheezes. Start karaoke nights in the Great Hall on Fridays. Tell Neville to keep up the good work. Hand out filibuster fireworks in class. Drop by St. Mungo's to visit Lockhart. Tell Arthur he's a lovely family. Look up Sybil for career advice. Well, nobody would do that. I know. Join SPED. It's SPEU. I mean W, you idiot. She nattered on about it for 4 hours last night. Tell Mooney I love you, man. Then again, he might, because Mooney's such a girl. Admit that he and Sirius are actually just fighting their mutual attraction to one another. Fine. Now it's going to be 10 things Mooney will never do at all. Tell a story that's shorter than 10 minutes. Quit nagging me about drinking too much fire whiskey. Stop visiting that bloody bad-tempered muggle. Tell Mad-Eye to fuck off. Let Molly know he gave the twins the map. Go an entire day without opening a book. Stop answering a question with a question. Say something nice about Malfoy. Act like he's even partly human before 9 a.m. Admit he fucked that banshee. The above piece of shite is dedicated to the memory of James Potter, the only other true marauder, and the only person who might possibly find it funny. George would think it was funny. Hell yeah, he would. Fucking George kicks ass. You're bloody well right on that. Fred and George kept up the marauder reign of terror at Hogwarts. We should do something in their honour, you know. I've got it. In memory of Fred Weasley, and in honour of George Weasley, the two best spawn to germinate in Molly's ever fertile blooming womb, we hereby... What the fuck are we going to do, Mooney? We, the two remaining true marauders, having permanently disbanded and hopefully before we die, torch the fuck up one Peter Pettigrew, do solemnly swear that we are and shall never be up to no good, and that George Albus Weasley shall hereafter be known as an honorary marauder for life, with all the rights and privileges thereof, in an expectation of adherence to the marauder code of honour, except for that bit about not killing another marauder because we still got to kill Pete, signed in year 2000, April 2nd, at the most anciently filthy and nastily nefarious House of Black, number 14, Grimmo. It's number 12, you fucking moron. No, it isn't. I know what number it is. You're thinking of Sissy's house. Don't write that. They've scratched it out. It's still there. Oh, go, you bloody fucker. You don't want an enchantment, this piece of shite. Give me that fucking quill. No! Now, we shall affix our signatures herein to make this most lawfully and awfully and dreadfully legal. Fine. Remus J. Lupin. Sirius A. Black. Let it go to your head, man.
"What's the Marauder Code of Honor?"
Timothy burst out excitedly. "That's on a whole separate parchment at home," George told him knowingly. "Wizards are big on treatises and codes of honor and stuff like that. It's like Marauder rules. No stealing another Marauder's girlfriend. You're duty-bound to help another Marauder, even unto death. No mischief that actually hurts anybody. Things of that sort."
"Is that why you wouldn't leave Lupin when Kingsley told you to?"
Timothy asked him shrewdly.
"Neville told me about that."
"Yeah, I wouldn't have left him anyway, but it got me out of a lot of trouble with Shacklebolt. Disobeying a direct order is a really bad thing, so I showed him the Marauder Code of Honor and told him I'd taken an oath to follow it."
"And this worked?"
Slage asked politely.
"Yeah, thank God," George shuddered. "Shacklebolt's a bear when he's pissed."
"Neville wouldn't leave,"
Timothy intoned loyally.
"Neville was in charge. The captain doesn't ever leave. He's meant to go down with the ship, you know," George grinned.
"Who in the hell was Sissy?" Quentin frowned, and George shrugged.
"You don't know?" he responded mockingly.
"Really?
I thought he told you everything!"
"We'd better go!"
Slosh broke in quickly and yanked Timothy along beside her. But Quentin and George just fixed one another with murderous stares and did not move.
"I'm only being polite to you because Timothy and Solange are here," George announced coldly when they were out of earshot. "Come to my store by yourself and I'll throw your ass right out onto the street. I won't even use the troll."
Quentin gave him an irritated look.
"I sent him an apology letter, you know."
"Did you?" George hissed furiously. "Did you? That's it? And all the things you possibly could have said? Why was it you're not welcome here?"
"Why do they keep on about that?" Quentin thought impatiently.
"I've said worse shit before, and he never gave a damn," he snapped back. "Why he's holding a grudge about this, I've no idea."
George gave him a look of utter disgust.
"You really don't get it, do you? You were one damn dumb muggle. And if it weren't for the fact that I'd rather not breakfast with Dementors, I'd cover you in pink feathers and shrink your dick to the size of a pea."
"Shut the fuck up!" Quentin growled, deciding this was a bit much.
"I'll beat the shit out of you."
George appeared delighted by this statement.
"Please do," he said scornfully. "Please, I'm begging you. Magic against a muggle's allowed for self-defense, you know. I'll blast you up against that wall and cut your bloody head off."
He took out his wand and pointed at his phoenix sword, which hung on a hook on the wall, and it promptly zoomed into his hand.
"Quentin!"
Slosh called fretfully from the front. Quentin thought briefly of a conversation he'd had with Lupin after first meeting George, when he'd commented on his apparent inability to do anything besides joke around.
"Don't let him fool you," Lupin had replied thoughtfully. "He takes his family and his friends' honor very seriously. He's quite useful to the Order as well, since he's utterly and entirely fearless."
"You needn't concern yourself," Quentin told George curtly. "I won't be back."
This has been the worst summer ever, Rosie thought gloomily. It has totally sucked ass. Despite the fact that she'd been to visit Elizabeth and Lupin a dozen times, she had yet to see Neville, and the only owl she'd received was an apologetic one, but so distant she hadn't even bothered to reply. "He hates me because my dad's an asshole," she thought angrily. "And that's totally not fair. I wasn't mad at him about his stupid gran." Her mother had stayed angry with Quentin for approximately 2 days before deciding everyone was being much too hard on him, especially since he'd sent what she swore were heartfelt letters of apology to both Elizabeth and Lupin. Rosie wasn't quite as easily convinced, especially when her mother showed her Lupin's reply, which was quite courteous but made no mention of the two of them seeing each other again. "He knows if he's telling the truth," Rosie thought wrathfully, "and he must not think he is." She could hardly bear to sit at the table and look at the three empty seats, especially Elizabeth's, who had been there her whole life. And although she wasn't upset with Solange, her mother was much less cheerful and fun than she'd been before, and their relationship had become rather strained, something else she blamed entirely on her father. The only upshot was that she'd had quite enough angsty material to finish her second album, and was actually looking forward to touring, anything to get out of the house. It was some consolation that Jamie had turned on Quentin 2 hours after the incident occurred, apparently the length of time it took Neville to owl his friends and fill them in on all the gossip. Ginny had fired off a furious missive to Jamie in which she declared her undying loyalty to her captain of the Order, and declared she was never speaking to his father or going to his house again, and therefore saw no need for their relationship to continue. This raised her a few notches in Rosie's estimation, but had led to a knockdown, drag-out fight at breakfast the next morning when Jamie threw the parchment at Quentin and told him to kiss his motherfucking ass. After that, Rosie and her brother became allies, and the two of them often sat outside after dinner, bitterly complaining about how Quentin had ruined their lives, and they couldn't possibly understand why their mother put up with him.
"It's time to go to dinner,"
Slage reminded Quentin an hour after their return as he sat scowling at his easel. Can't I just shoot myself instead? He replied nastily.
Oh, honestly, she wailed. You are always in a bad mood. I'm getting so tired of it.
I'm supposed to be excited about going to dinner, Quentin responded crossly. Perhaps your mother will do a striptease on the table, or Kenny will shit on the floor again. Maybe Rosie will throw her bloody plate at me, or Tim will blow up the whole godforsaken house playing with his new magic wand. One can only hope.
Oh, for heaven's sake!
Solange shrieked and flew out of the room.
I got all my Hogwarts stuff today,
Timothy yelled enthusiastically as the Mansionites dug into their dinner.
It was really fun. George showed us his honorary marauder certificate, and I want to be one too.
He began happily waving his wand about, and everyone ducked as red sparks flew wildly in all directions.
Capital, Timothy! Capital!
Sir Richard beamed between bites of roast beef.
Off to school tomorrow, are we? Mustn't forget to write me, you know.
Sure, I'll write you, Grandpa.
Tim replied cheerfully.
And you can read everybody my letters.
Excellent, my boy, excellent. I've had quite the good day myself, I say,
Richard proclaimed delightedly.
I've found the one, I believe, and I've invited her to dinner tomorrow.
Everyone at the table groaned. Richard had stubbornly kept up his internet search for a new wife all summer, while making sure to give everyone daily reports on how things were going.
Why, I believe she's ace. She's brill, I say. She's bang tidy.
Grandfather, Jamie barked out irritably, you aren't a teenager. Quit trying to sound like one.
It makes you feel young again, Richard replied unrepentantly. There's a great deal of women answering my inquiries. Everything's going tickety-boo, I say. It seems I'm quite the catch,
he finished complacently.
They're after your money and your title, Quentin told him sardonically, but Richard appeared not to have heard this.
I don't need the internet to find a boyfriend,
Lady Fanshawe screeched and stabbed Richard in the stomach with her fork.
I have already got one, and I'm bringing him to dinner tomorrow, too.
Oh, my God, Quentin muttered furiously to Solange. Your parents are fucking nuts. Now I know where Loretta gets it from.
I already had that,
Loretta shrieked angrily. As usual, she looked rather frightful tonight with her incredibly frizzy hair. Apparently, she permed it every other day, and purple eyeshadow smeared past her eyebrows up to her hairline. After awakening from her stupefied state, Quentin had attempted unsuccessfully to readmit her to the mental hospital, only to find her steadfast declarations that she was just trying to scare her sister, believed by every idiotic doctor in the country. Apparently, Dr. von Schlesenberg had spread the word about this poor woman, who was terrorized by her rude and intolerable husband, who imagined he could bribe physicians into declaring her incompetent, and not a single psychiatrist in England would even return his calls. Loretta now had a guardian, a large, boxy sort of woman with iron-gray hair and stern eyes, who had been a military nurse for 15 years and an ER nurse for 20, brooked no nonsense from anyone, occasionally told Quentin to lower his voice, and had actually forced Kenny to bathe. Despite these impressive accomplishments, even she could not stop the whining.
Nobody cares about me!
Loretta howled and threw herself to the floor. You've got that right, Quentin thought bitterly. Even Saint Motherfucking Lupin hated your ass.
I might as well just shrivel up and die!
Loretta screeched pitifully.
Nobody would even notice!
Maybe Tim could start shrinking you then,
Jamie told her spitefully, and Loretta let out a great shriek of anguish.
Oh, now my own son turns on me after I dedicated my life to his happiness.
Can you not make her shut the fuck up?
Quentin shouted at the nurse, whose name, ironically enough, was Angel.
Now, without stuffing a rag in her mouth, she replied calmly, she needs her medications adjusted. Told that fool of a doctor twice.
Quentin closed his eyes in disgust. Angel and Dr. O'Malley had been at each other's throats since their arrival.
Who's your new boyfriend, Grandmother?
Timothy asked her interestedly. He, of course, was the only one that found Richard and Caroline's feud entertaining.
It's Albert! He's always been in love with me!
Caroline pronounced triumphantly and gave Richard a scathing look.
Albert! Richard bellowed, his face red as a beet. Well, I never! That old pansy ass of a gardener!
Yes, Lady Fanshawe hissed wickedly. We've been snogging behind the rose bushes, and tomorrow night we're going to do it.
Jamie and Rosie looked at each other with their mouths hanging open, for once completely speechless with horror. And Timothy waved his wand again and set the entire tablecloth on fire.
Sorry,
he shrieked in a panic-stricken voice.
I'm just trying to see what it can do.
Everyone leapt up shouting as the ceiling sprinklers began blasting jets of water, and within 2 minutes they were all soaked to the skin. Rosie glanced over at Jamie.
I hate my life,
she told her brother in a resigned voice as water dripped off her nose. This has got to be the best summer ever, Elizabeth thought dreamily as she gazed at the golden sunset. It's been totally unbelievable. She and Lupin and Teddy were having dinner at their favorite outdoor cafe, the Blue Feather, a triangular brick edifice on the corner of Ferncliff's most traveled street. From the patio where they sat beneath a canopy of ivy entwined with orange, cream, and rust-colored roses was a perfect view of the cobblestone street below, where a stream of brightly dressed witches and wizards strolled along, bowing, sweeping off hats, and enthusiastically greeting their acquaintances. The elf servers, apparently female, as they were dressed in pink taffeta aprons, a sight which always made Elizabeth giggle, and sported yellow silk bows atop their ugly gnome-like faces, bustled cheerily about in obsequious attendance, and in the distance, miles of rolling green hills ablaze with autumn leaves of crimson red, sparkling gold, and bright orange shimmered in the setting sun.
Eat your turnips, they're good for you,
Lupin told Teddy sternly, and he cast a desperate look at Elizabeth.
They're looking at me!
He wailed. Lupin appeared completely exasperated by this comment.
Eat the turnips,
he hissed threateningly,
and lower your voice.
I am never eating these turnips,
Teddy shouted melodramatically.
I will die if I eat these turnips!
You needn't carry on like that, Elizabeth told him sternly. Eat your turnips or you won't be helping the climbing boy clean out the chimneys tonight.
Teddy began stuffing the turnips into his mouth at a rapid rate, and Lupin gave her a grateful look. The summer had been a blur of activity as Lupin used his leave of absence to fix things up exactly to Elizabeth's satisfaction, although he had gotten her instructions backward and painted the house bright red and the barn blue. She wouldn't dream of mentioning it, however, since he obviously spent every waking moment trying to make her happy. Something so astonishing to her that 3 months later she still found it difficult to believe. They strolled home hand in hand down neatly swept sidewalks, which flanked red cobblestone streets, Teddy dancing behind them, chattering excitedly, and stopped at the Chandler's cart to purchase more candles for Elizabeth's Halloween decor. 100 feet later, they encountered the costermonger's display, selected a few enormous tomatoes and summer squash, and a block further entered the bewitching baker's breads and puddings for an assortment of scones, tarts, and pies. Upon exiting the store, Teddy screeched to a halt and let out a shriek of delight.
Dad! The pie man!
He hollered frantically. The pieman, a youngish fellow with a dour expression, halted his long blue wagon and climbed down to greet them in a gloomy voice, unlatching the rear gate to display his wares.
What's in this beef pie?
Lupin asked the pieman suspiciously. Beef? The man replied in a surly voice.
You're lying,
he responded pleasantly, and the pieman sighed, but did not appear offended.
Right, governor. It's dog. But I didn't kill it. Found it dead.
Elizabeth was horrified by this proclamation and hurried back onto the sidewalk. But Teddy and Lupin did not seem the slightest bit surprised.
We'll take an apple,
Lupin told him cheerfully and handed the man 5 sickles.
You can't ever buy that beef pie,
Teddy instructed Elizabeth sternly when they started off again, their packages and the apple pie floating a few feet ahead.
Nor the mutton or the eel. Not that anybody would want some old eel pie.
Albus loved eel pie, Lupin said reminiscently. He'd sit and eat it at the table at Grim Old Place and it made everybody sick. Even Severus would get this repulsed look on his face and jump up and stalk off. He probably did it just to get rid of us, he mused. The apple pie's fine, though. Arabella Fig makes those. You know the old squib woman that kept an eye on Harry when he was living at Privet Drive.
Sometimes she babysits me,
Teddy told Elizabeth disgustedly.
Just like she did Harry. And then I have to hear all about her cat. But she doesn't want to hear about mine.
The orange girl was standing forlornly on the corner in her long brown smock with a basket of sadly shriveled and dried up oranges. But Elizabeth knew Lupin would stop as soon as he saw her.
How are you, Ariane? He asked politely. We'll take the rest of these, then you can go home.
The girl's face lit up.
Thanks!
She squealed and tore off down the street.
There aren't many poor in Ferncliff, Lupin told Elizabeth, but Ariane's family is one of them. Her father spends all their money on claret and crumpets. For himself, of course.
Elizabeth gave the girl's retreating figure a sympathetic look.
This village is like some enchanted 19th-century town, she remarked happily, without the horrible smell and sewage everywhere.
Well, I suppose it is, Lupin replied thoughtfully. It's just a different sort of world because, well, I think because Muggles trust in technology and we rely on magic, and even with the crossover of customs between us, we're still much more isolated. It's rather difficult to mingle with people who don't believe you're real, he said wryly.
Why don't Muggles think we're real, Aunt Elizabeth?
Teddy asked loudly.
We weren't brought up to believe in wizards or magic, she replied calmly. People think it's nonsense.
Teddy sighed and shook his head, but politely did not comment. The next block was the town square, a large grassy area populated with strolling musicians, ancient tale tellers, families picnicking on levitating blankets, and children dancing beneath the stars. There was an utter lack of discordant noise, only the pleasant hum of cheerful voices, twittering fairies, and the hush of a muted watercolor twilight, its air sharp and clear. Elizabeth mentally contrasted this lovely stroll home with a night in London, riding home from a restaurant in a stuffy, stale-smelling automobile through loud, bright, and traffic-filled streets, and realized she not only did not miss the Muggle world, she was incredibly thankful to have escaped it. While electricity did not work in the village, something Lupin had valiantly attempted to explain in an hour-long dissertation on physics, magical theory, and particle separation, apparently satellite did, which meant her laptop provided communication with the rest of the world, an occasional movie or TV show, and the ability to do online shopping. Rosie and Tim visited frequently, often spending the night in the guest rooms. Solange dropped by occasionally, although she always seemed a bit uncomfortable. Lucretia brought dinner every other Thursday, her night off, and stayed a few hours. And Richard had made a tearfully apologetic visit, during which he blubbered into his handkerchief so much Elizabeth had become rather alarmed. One of the old tale tellers began a loud rhyming story about the olden days, when trolls and dinosaurs populated the town and the dirt roads were spotted with only rudimentary shacks, and Teddy stopped immediately to listen.
That's what I'm going to do when I'm old,
Lupin whispered to Elizabeth as he stood with his blue cloak flapping behind him in the wind.
Sit around the town square and tell stories to children.
Good,
Elizabeth replied sweetly.
I'll sit next to you and pet the stray cats and listen.
He smiled at this and thought of how utterly gorgeous Elizabeth had become over the summer, with her light tan, sparkling eyes, longer black hair, and radiant skin, and how often she seemed to be smiling now. There was her subtle, pseudo-prim half-smile as she attempted to be stern, the teasing smile with flushed cheeks when he flirted with her, the quick, unconscious smile when he came into a room, the affectionate and maternal smile she used with Teddy, and her dazzling smile. Once almost vanished entirely, that he saw at least twice a day.
You'll be the old tale teller, and I'll be the crazy old cat lady,
Elizabeth proclaimed happily.
And we can sit out in the garden and talk at night, and you won't ever have to go off to work.
But you won't be there when I'm old, Lupin thought suddenly. He started walking again, relieved that he was several inches taller than she, and wouldn't see the tears in his eyes. Quentin pulled out a Raymond Chandler detective novel and leaned back in bed with Solange, who had curled up next to him with one of her French poetry books.
I just wish things would be the same as before, she said sadly. It would have been a lot of fun if Elizabeth and Remus went with us today. You could have teased him about that parchment, she added hopefully. Maybe you should go talk to him. I think it means more if you apologize in person and not just in a letter.
I'm not begging him to be my friend, Quentin replied resentfully. He's done with me, and I'm done with him, he added firmly and turned back to his book.
Down these mean streets a man must go who is not himself mean, who is neither tarnished nor afraid. He must be a complete man and a common man, and yet an unusual man. He must be, to use a rather weathered phrase, a man of honor and courage, by instinct, by inevitability, without thought of it, and without even knowing it. Quentin tossed the book aside as if the pages had burned his hands.
I don't feel like reading, he said shortly in response to Solange's puzzled gaze.
The next day, Quentin remembered Richard and Caroline's announcements that they were bringing dates to dinner as he stepped into the elevator, and thought to himself that he probably should have brought his rifle. He was most unimpressed to hear shouting before the elevator door even opened. Richard was bellowing at the top of his lungs at the terrified old gardener Albert, whose arm was clutched in a vice-like grip by Lady Fanshawe.
Think you're going to shag my wife?
He shouted as Jamie and Rosie let out their usual shrieks of protest, and Timothy tried to levitate Kenny out of his chair, an effort which only succeeded in dumping him onto the floor.
No,
Albert stammered as he looked frantically back and forth from Sir Richard to Lady Fanshawe, as if trying to ascertain which of them posed the greatest threat to his safety.
I'll shoot your bloody head off, I say. There won't be any rumpy-pumpy going on under my nose.
Rosie began giggling furiously.
Where does he come up with these words?
She whispered to Jamie, who was grinning himself.
Honestly, he either tries to sound like a teenager or like he's 100 years old.
I won't do anything,
Albert squealed in despair, and Lady Fanshawe smacked him soundly on the side of the head.
Man, bad decision, dude,
Kenny said knowingly from the floor, where he appeared quite undisturbed.
Everybody knows he can't shoot that rifle, dude. He'd miss you by a mile, man. She's the one that'll kick your ass, dude.
Albert looked at Lady Fanshawe's glowering face and emitted a small squeak of terror.
Albert loves me,
Caroline howled stridently.
Yeah, Henry remarked in his bored voice. You can't tell.
He does! He does! She shrieked wildly. Don't you, Albert?
Albert looked desperately around the room for some sort of assistance.
Let him alone, Mother, Solange said tartly. You're just trying to make Dad jealous, and he's trying to make you jealous. And we all know it,
she finished in a satisfied voice. MacDonald appeared with his haughty look and stiffly pronounced,
A Miss Bingham, sir, did a guest for Sir Richard Fanshawe.
Ha! Richard shouted triumphantly at his wife. I see my date has arrived.
MacDonald was followed by a rather squirrely-looking 60-ish woman with frizzy gray hair pulled back in a bun, thick horn-rimmed glasses, and an inordinate amount of orange lipstick. She wore an obviously secondhand plaid skirt and jacket that were rather tight on her dumpy figure.
Hello,
Richard said to her politely and bowed, but he was obviously unimpressed.
You are Sylvia?
Yes, that's me,
she trilled and batted her heavily mascaraed eyelashes at him. Hmm, he muttered a bit too loudly.
Apparently that picture was a bit out of date.
I use my daughter's picture,
Sylvia announced proudly, as if this were quite a clever thing to do.
Gets me more dates. That's pretty smart, man,
Kenny told her as he slithered back up into his chair.
Cause, like, if you used your picture, dude, you wouldn't get any dates. I'll shag you, man.
He added hopefully.
He doesn't have any money, Henry remarked as Sylvia perused Kenny with interest. No title either. He's from the States.
She immediately turned back to Richard.
My, you're even handsomer than in your picture,
she beamed, and Richard's round face turned red with pleasure.
Oh my God,
Rosie hissed to Jamie.
How retarded is he?
Pretty retarded, Jamie replied with a yawn. Even I know how to weed out the ones that are just after my money. I tell them I'm not inheriting anything.
I tell guys my manager stole all my money and I'm broke,
Rosie replied cheerfully.
They still want to shag me, though.
Second-hand clothes, Caroline shrilled as she favored Sylvia with a contemptuous expression. No breeding whatsoever. This is the best you can do, Richard. Least I'm not snogging the gardener,
Richard bellowed back, and they began pelting one another with chips. Albert, meanwhile, had ducked underneath the table, and Quentin couldn't resist smiling when he peered up at him on all fours from beside his chair.
Mr. Quiller, sir, he whispered frantically. I've done a good job for you, sir, for 15 years. You've got to help me out, sir. My life's in danger here. I was almost killed by a poker flying out of the sky, and now...
You say you were almost killed by a poker flying from the sky,
Quentin said in an amused voice and glanced down the table, only to find for the millionth time that he'd momentarily forgotten Lupin wasn't there.
This fucking sucks, he thought angrily. Who knew he could hold such a damn grudge?
Asshole.
Poker flying from the sky? Codswallop,
Richard boomed out. Apparently our own boyfriend's mental, I say.
Both of you shut the fuck up, Quentin said wrathfully. He isn't mental, Richard. That bloody werewolf threw one out his 15-story window. And he's not interested in you, Caroline, so let him the hell alone,
he finished threateningly.
Fine, then,
Lady Fanshawe screeched and burst into tears.
Just take away my new lover.
Lupin threw a poker out of his window,
Rosie yelled disbelievingly.
You never had any old lover,
Richard yelled back mockingly.
You were after him, and he was only after Elizabeth.
I did,
Caroline wailed dramatically.
He had feelings for me, and I knew it, until my own daughter, that tainted harlot,
she shrieked, and Solange began glaring at her dreadfully. Albert was still under the table.
Will you please come out? Quentin snapped, and Albert looked more terrified than ever. He'll shoot me, he whispered pleadingly. I know it. She keeps grabbing at me private area.
He blushed alarmingly. Quentin glanced over at Solange.
"Will you divorce me if I kill your parents?" he asked her conversationally.
"I don't know,"
she replied calmly. "Well, I'm not taking a chance." "Now listen up," he shouted and gave both the elderly Fanshawes a threatening look. "Both of you, leave Albert the fuck alone. Anyone that hurts him or tries to molest him," he stared pointedly at Lady Fanshawe. "What? What?" she shrieked. "I never. Just what are you insinuating?" "You heard me," he replied rudely. "If either of you goes near him, I'll take away all your rifles." This was to Richard. "And I'll tell every last member of your bloody garden club that you've been trying to shag the gardener." Both of them jumped to their feet. Well, I have never been so insulted in all of my life," Lady Fanshawe howled. I say, old boy, you're getting quite out of line. Treating the elderly in this fashion," Lady Fanshawe shrieked. "Come along, my dear," Richard glowered at his wife and offered his arm to the beaming Sylvia. "I believe we shall dine elsewhere." "Please do," Quentin barked out nastily as they strolled out the door. Lady Fanshawe strode behind Quentin, snatched up his tea, and poured it over his head.
"You can slap her," Solange told him amiably.
"I can't slap an old lady," he replied through gritted teeth, and Solange stuck out her foot and tripped her mother as she sailed past. Lady Fanshawe crashed to the ground and began to wail.
"Hey, man,"
Kenny hissed. He had crawled up behind Albert underneath the table and positioned himself next to Quentin's right knee.
"This is totally cool under here, dude. It's like all dark and shit. This is fun, man."
"My hip is broken!" Lady Fanshawe screamed from the floor. "It's broken! My own daughter broke my hip!" Solange rolled her eyes in disbelief and poured her glass of tea over her mother's head.
"That's what you get!" she snapped. "That's what you did to Quentin and everything you've said about Elizabeth that is not true! And Remus never had the slightest interest in you,"
she added spitefully. Angel jerked Loretta out of her chair and stomped over to examine Lady Fanshawe for approximately half a second. "It's broken," she announced authoritatively, and Loretta snickered.
"No, it's not," Solange yelped in a shocked voice. "It's not. You don't know."
"I was an ER nurse for 20 years, Angel snarled, "and I certainly know an obviously fractured hip when I see one. Shortening an external rotation. You'd better call an ambulance. Hip fractures are very serious in the elderly," she finished dourly.
"Who's your favorite now, mother?"
Loretta screamed with a horrifically crazed grin.
"None of you!"
Lady Fanshawe bellowed. "You three are the worst daughters any woman could possibly have. Trying to kill me. No respect. No morals whatsoever. Throwing things at me. A helpless old woman." Dr. O'Malley strode in with his bag and began barking orders, all of which Angel completely ignored in his exclamatory fashion, and shortly thereafter the ambulance arrived. Lady Fanshawe immediately quit screeching and began sniffling pathetically.
"Had a bit of a fall, ma'am?"
the senior paramedic asked politely as he did a brief examination. "Well," Lady Fanshawe whispered in a small, frightened voice,
my own daughter tripped me."
She began crying softly, and the two medics exchanged looks of disbelief.
"Well, you deserved it,"
Solange squealed and jumped to her feet.
"I didn't know your hip would break."
The medics gave her a look of revulsion.
I tried to do what they say,"
Lady Fanshawe whispered miserably.
"I try not to make them mad."
She covered her face with her hands.
"Absolutely disgraceful," barked the senior medic. "Elder abuse. This is a reportable crime, you know."
"How'd your head get all wet, ma'am?"
asked the younger medic with a concerned air.
She...
Lady Fanshawe began sobbing again.
"She dumped her tea on my head after she broke my hip."
"You needn't worry, ma'am," the senior medic said in a loud voice. "We'll take you to the hospital and they'll sort this all out. You'll not be subject to this abuse again."
"You don't know how horrible she is,"
Solange screamed angrily, and Quentin winced.
"Will you shut up? You're making this worse," he hissed. "Even Brian's not going to be able to get you out of this one. You have to go and confess to two fucking paramedics and a doctor."
Timothy climbed onto the Hogwarts Express without the slightest bit of trepidation. He had heard all the stories from Lupin, Harry, and Neville about the train, and wasn't intimidated at all by the sullen seventh years that lounged around and glared at him from the first compartments.
"The older boys will try to frighten you," Lupin had warned him. "They'll tell you one of the boats sinks every year, that the sea serpent will come up and swallow you, or how evil the professors are, or that you're going to get beat up every day. Just ignore them."
"Equal firsties!"
sang out a couple of fifth and sixth years as he trooped past, and Timothy put on the haughty and pinched-up look he'd used at the Valentine's ball and sailed right past them. When he reached the third years, an oafish-looking boy stuck out his foot and tripped him, and Timothy jumped up and yelled for a prefect.
"You're going to get detention before you even get to school,"
he told the boy threateningly, and received a dreadful scowl in return.
"Nobody gets detention before they even get to school," the boy replied disgustedly. "You don't know anything. You're going to get beat up every day." "Ha!" Timothy shouted. "Lupin told me somebody would say that. Now you better tell me about the sea serpent and the boat."
The boy scowled again. Apparently he'd been planning on doing just that.
"Who told you that?" "Lupin,"
Timothy enunciated as clearly as Snape.
"Remus Lupin. He's told me everything about Hogwarts," he said proudly.
"You're full of shite. You don't know any aurors,"
the boy replied and turned away, and Timothy angrily stomped his foot. The second year compartment wasn't much better. Apparently they were drunk with the power of their first chance to terrorize.
"Firstie, I bet you'll be the one the sea serpent eats this year. Wait till you meet the new defense teacher. He's a vampire. If you don't do your homework, I'll suck your blood." "Who cares?"
Timothy yawned, and they all looked disappointed, obviously thinking that he, being the smallest, would definitely be an easy target. He knew he'd almost reached the back when the students were no longer dressed in house colors, and all appeared either frightened or swaggered about with a false show of bravado.
"Just sit with anyone who looks friendly,"
Lupin had told him. But Tim didn't see anyone who seemed particularly interested in him. They all seemed to know one another. He noticed a red-headed boy with freckles that made him think of the Weasleys, and followed him into a compartment, where the boy sat down, put his feet up, and began blowing bubbles that made loud farting noises when they popped.
"Cool,"
Timothy told him approvingly.
"Did you get those at Weasley's Wizarding Wheezes?"
"Yup," the boy replied nonchalantly.
"They're ace, aren't they? Get a lot of free stuff, because the owner's my cousin, and I'm his favorite cousin, because they named me after his brother that died." "You're George's cousin?"
Timothy burst out delightedly.
"I know him! He came to our Valentine's ball in my mom and stepdad's wedding, and I was at this battle he was in, and he showed me his honorary marauder scroll." "Brill!"
shrieked the boy and stood up and shook Timothy's hand.
"My name's Frederick Alexander Weasley,"
he said proudly,
"but they all call me Alex. My mom thought if they called me Fred, it would make my Uncle Arthur sad." "I know Arthur too,"
Timothy yelled.
"He shot my stepfather right through the heart, and I wish he would have killed him."
Alex burst out laughing.
"I heard about that," he grinned. "I know who you are now. Your name's Tim, right?"
He looked satisfied when Timothy nodded.
"Yeah, I was at Uncle Arthur's last week, and they were talking about you."
Timothy beamed at this.
"I think George is the coolest," he announced. "I want to be an honorary marauder, too."
"Me too. We could do it together,"
Alex hissed conspiratorially.
"We've got to get somebody else, though. If we want to be like the real marauders, there's got to be three of us. I'm not counting Peter,"
he added, and Timothy nodded in agreement. They both started perusing the corridors for anyone they might kidnap into their little gang, but agreed that the black-haired fellow looked boring, the one with the curly hair was way too girly, and the boy with the square head and mean eyes was definitely going to end up in Slytherin.
"You don't know who your dad is, do you?"
Alex asked him bluntly. Timothy wasn't at all surprised at this, coming from the mansion. Almost nothing offended him.
"No, I don't know who my dad is, and Lupin's going to take me on a spy trip, and I wish he'd hurry up and do it. He said he already went back and did some groundwork." "What's that?"
"I don't know,"
Timothy replied irritably.
"Something that makes it take longer. He says it's more complicated than he thought, but I guess I'll know if they put me in Slytherin,"
he said with a worried frown. Just the thought of it made his stomach clench up.
"Well, Weasleys are always Gryffindors, and I bet I'll be the first one in 300 years who isn't,"
Alex added darkly.
"Even Percy got in Gryffindor. I think it's bollocks he didn't have that duel with Lupin, don't you? You won't even tell me why he backed out." "He was really mad when he found out my Aunt Elizabeth was going to have a baby,"
Timothy hissed knowingly.
"My brother still writes to Ginny even though they broke up. And she told him when Percy found out, he started yelling that Aunt Elizabeth was a muggle slut and she wasn't worth fighting over. So my brother Jamie had me take him to the ministry, see? Because Percy said that about our aunt and he was going to beat him up. And Percy got scared and ran out of his office and my brother is a muggle."
He finished triumphantly and they both broke out laughing. A skinny little boy with glasses and rather mousy brown hair stuck his head in the compartment.
"Hey,"
he said nervously.
Can I I'm sitting here. Do you mind?"
"Sure," Tim and Alex replied promptly and smiled at each other. And Timothy wondered if Alex, like himself, was trying to be as good as possible to make sure he got into Gryffindor.
"This is excellent,"
Lupin announced when he unrolled the parchment scroll Arthur's owl had brought. They had just finished dinner and were watching Fire Whiskey and Peeves, a neon green cat with purple eyes that Lupin had gotten that day as a surprise present for Elizabeth, chase each other around the room.
"Arthur's having tournament tonight." "What's that?" "It's a game. It's great, Aunt Elizabeth!"
Teddy shrieked and raced back into the room, apparently having overheard the magical word tournament.
"You have to play it in the back garden because the pieces are so big, and there's a troll and a goblin and a hag and..."
"They're just enchanted game pieces," Lupin explained hastily. "They aren't real. You choose one as your player, you know, like that money game where you buy houses and property."
"Monopoly?"
Elizabeth queried. "I suppose you played that with Quentin." "Yeah, he always killed me. Anyway, tournament's more like that trivia game you all liked at the mansion with categories and questions to answer."
"Oh, like Trivial Pursuit. I love that," Elizabeth beamed. "What are the categories?"
"Well, there are magical sports, famous witches and wizards, muggle studies, charms, defense against the dark arts, entertainment, history of magic."
"Who's going to be there?"
"Arthur and Molly and George and Ron and Hermione. Oh, and Harry."
They sounded like a reasonably sized group to Elizabeth, and she actually met them all.
"What am I to wear?" "Do I get to dress you then?"
he grinned.
"I suppose you do,"
she replied primly. The back garden of the burrow, with its patchy dirt and grass, sprawled at least 500 yards. Hens scuttled about, happily pecking away at any stray garden gnome that might sprint across the field, and Molly had arranged deck chairs and a table of refreshments in front of 7 stone pieces that were at least 6 feet tall. Elizabeth decided they didn't bother her from the deck chairs, and she supposed one got used to them after a while. Teddy was dancing around, sticking his tongue out at the troll and trying to climb on his club. Arthur had been in a state of near ecstasy when they arrived, and announced to Elizabeth in a reverent tone as he sat down that she was the first muggle to ever visit his house.
"Remus still doesn't know how aeroplanes stay up in the sky," he said and shot Lupin a resentful look, "even after living with you all for 6 months.
"Don't be upset with him. We don't know either," Elizabeth laughed. "I guess I could look it up on my computer, though."
"Wonderful," Arthur beamed. "Have you ever seen one? You know, up close?"
"I've flown in one several times,"
Elizabeth replied, and smiled as not only Arthur but Lupin looked quite impressed indeed.
"Amazing!" Arthur shouted. "Now that's bravery, I tell you!"
"Definitely would have been Gryffindor,"
Lupin grinned and Elizabeth flushed. She knew this was probably the highest compliment he could give anyone.
"Now I want to be the troll," Molly announced bossily. "You all know it's my turn."
"You should be the hag, Mom," George said innocently and winked at Elizabeth.
He was sitting on her other side. She imagined to distance himself as far as possible from his mother.
"I haven't been the troll in ages," Ron said hotly. "Now, we'll pick it out of the hat," Arthur responded sternly. "That's fair."
"Why does everyone want to be the troll?"
Elizabeth asked interestedly.
"There's a dueling card, and if you pick that, all the pieces start fighting, and the last one standing moves forward 30 feet. It's generally the troll,"
Lupin explained.
"He's bigger than the others, and the hag's a terrible coward. Nobody wants her."
There were murmurs of assent from the crowd.
"Well, there are only 7 pieces," Elizabeth said in a puzzled voice. "And there are 8 of us."
There was an awkward pause.
"Well," Arthur broke in a bit too early, "we didn't, imagine you'd want to play the categories, you know."
"They think I don't know anything," Elizabeth thought indignantly, but smiled sweetly in response.
"Oh, I don't care if I'm in last place. I think it would be fun to just play."
"Well, good for you,"
Arthur said delightedly, and the others all chimed in their agreement, except for Molly, who just shook her head sadly.
"Oh, please, just let me beat her," Elizabeth thought desperately.
Molly had already dropped several remarks about Elizabeth's lack of cooking skills, Teddy's resemblance to dear Tonks, and pointedly asked her just when they were supposedly getting married. She wasn't about to tell her Lupin hadn't brought up the subject again, and she certainly wasn't going to. She still had the nagging impression he'd only asked her because of the baby.
"Molly's a pain in the ass," Lupin had warned her. "She annoys the shit out of everybody. If she isn't screaming at someone or trying to control them, she can't hardly stand herself."
"Well, you might as well play," Molly finally said snippily. "You might feel out of place if you didn't."
"But must irritate someone at least every 5 minutes," George whispered to Elizabeth. "She's got behind while she was in the kitchen." "All right, no peeking. Close your eyes."
Arthur pulled a card out of a large velvet top hat, which read Sea Serpent, and the serpentine stone statue slithered over about 10 feet in front of him. George hissed, "Perfect," in her ear when Molly pulled the vampire card, and Elizabeth smiled, both from his comment and the fact that the vampire statue would now be rather far away from her. Ron, who was next to Molly, pulled the dragon and seemed pleased, but Harry scowled horribly.
"It's my favorite piece. I never get it," he mumbled.
"I got the troll,"
Hermione shrieked with delight and clapped her hands.
"Oh, I want to win."
Everybody laughed and Hermione blushed.
"Hermione's the only one who's honest," Lupin pronounced and gave Hermione an affectionate glance. "The rest of us just sit around and say it's just a game."
"It's never just a game to a bunch of Gryffindors," Arthur told Elizabeth knowingly as Harry reached into the hat.
"I'll get the werewolf," he predicted dourly. "It's kind of funny. Remus never gets him."
"The hag!" he barked out in disgust as he looked at his card.
"Damn, I hate her. Nobody better pull that dueling card," he informed them all darkly.
"Last time they dueled, she went off and hid in a bush," he informed Elizabeth.
"Her nickname's Percy," George announced. "Fred invented her."
"George!"
Molly shrieked, and George ducked as a dinner plate zoomed past his head.
"Had to happen eventually," Lupin said cheerfully. He'd pulled the werewolf card. "At least he won't run into the bushes like the hag. He'll go for the troll's throat,"
he called over to Hermione.
"Well, the troll's gonna smash him with his club,"
Hermione responded determinedly. "I really like her," Elizabeth thought, "especially since she knows better than to bring that baby." Everyone had warned her about Hilda's incessant fussiness.
"Unicorn! Get the unicorn!" George pleaded as Elizabeth put her hand in the hat, and she gave him a suspicious look.
"Why?"
"Unicorns are girly," he replied, and Ron nodded his agreement.
"I want the goblin.
Goblins are cool."
"Goblins are creepy,"
Elizabeth shuddered, thinking of Gringotts.
"They are,"
Hermione beamed at her.
"I've always thought that."
George whooped with delight as he pulled out the goblin card, and Elizabeth was quite pleased with the unicorn, who pranced over very gracefully, gave a bow, and then turned to line up beside the other pieces.
"Finish line's 200 yards away," Arthur told her, "and you get 10 yards for a correct question, 30 if you win the duel, and 50 for the group card."
"What's that?"
"Someone who isn't playing reads the card and everyone has a go at once. First to call out the correct answer can earn 50 points.
"There's definitely some luck involved then," Elizabeth mused. "You don't know what category that group card might pick."
"No," Arthur replied in a pleased voice. "That's how I won the last time. It picked a question from Muggle Studies. Hermione and I were the only ones that knew the answer, but I yelled it out first."
"We both jumped up to answer," Hermione explained, "and Arthur tried to knock me down."
Despite these words, she smiled very fondly at her father-in-law.
"Let's start," George said impatiently and threw the hat up in the air.
The hat spun around dramatically in the sky for a few moments before landing on Ron's head, and he reached inside it and pulled out the category, Charms.
"What is the incantation for charming a pen to spill ink on its user?"
a clear, sweet voice echoed from the card.
"Plumasusha," Ron replied promptly, and the dragon loped forward 10 feet. "Damn," George growled. "I'm the one who told you that."
Hermione was quite irritated when she pulled out a magical sports card and hadn't any idea who was the Bulgarian seeker that won the Quidditch tournament of 1912.
"Andor Crumb," Ron and Harry shouted in exasperation. "He's Vicky's great-great-great-grandfather," Ron added, and Hermione made a face as she flung the hat towards Harry.
Harry pulled History of Magic and hadn't a clue who had been the first head of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement.
"A lot of it's luck," Lupin told him consolingly. "See, I've got Muggle studies,"
he frowned.
"You live with Muggles," the group shouted in exasperation. "You have a Muggle girlfriend."
"Well, that doesn't mean I'll know the answer,"
he said resignedly as a man's nasal voice called out.
"State the Muggle term for love affair where a third party is involved as well. Clue, it includes a geometrical term."
Lupin appeared completely baffled by this.
"Oh, for heaven's sake," Hermione yelled. "A geometrical term, think."
"It's two words, Remus. Love, and then the geometrical term," Arthur shouted out.
"Well, I haven't any idea,"
Lupin replied irritably, as the werewolf turned and gave him a disgusted look.
"Sorry,"
he mumbled to the wolf.
"It's a love triangle," everyone except Ron and George shouted.
"That's stupid," Ron said sulkily.
"That's a stupid question."
Elizabeth sighed when she pulled out magical sports. "Name the Chudley Cannon Seeker who performed a 3-inch Ronsky feint."
"Harry Potter,"
Elizabeth said immediately, since she didn't know anyone else on the team, and remembered Lupin saying something to Harry about his Ronsky feint during the vampire attack on Hogsmeade. She squealed with glee when her unicorn galloped forward.
Why couldn't I have gotten that card? Harry grinned.
Does the hat know if you pick a card about yourself?
No, George said lazily. We were all tied at the end once, and Remus pulled out Famous Witches and Wizards, and it said, State the birthplace of the werewolf Aura, who's the leader of the Order of the Phoenix. We were so pissed we threw our drinks at him. Even Neville, he added cheerfully. It rarely ever happens, Arthur protested. There is some luck. Most of it's knowledge, though. This proved true as the game progressed. Hermione and Lupin regained the lead. Elizabeth picked two Muggle Studies questions in a row, which kept her at least ahead of Molly, who only seemed to know the entertainment category and was being cast quite venomous looks by her vampire. Ron and George didn't seem to be taking the game seriously, since their dragon and goblin pieces kept running around the others with the obvious intent of annoying them. This activity stopped when Hermione's troll bashed the goblin with its club, and the goblin staggered back to his proper place, holding his head and squealing piteously. "Damn, Hermione!" George yelled out. "You bloody well killed him!"
"I didn't do it," she replied disgustedly. "He's just had enough of you two. You should have grabbed him there."
"Group!" Arthur bellowed excitedly when he pulled the next card. "This could be for the game! Teddy!" Lupin and Hermione, who were 10 feet from the finish line, gave each other evilly competitive stares. And Elizabeth, Arthur, and Harry, who were 50 feet back, exchanged hopeful, "We can beat them with this one card" looks. Even the pieces were obviously interested. Hermione's troll gave the werewolf a threatening look and waved its club, and the wolf glared back menacingly.
"The category is..."
Teddy paused dramatically until everyone began shouting.
"Okay, okay. The category is History of Magic."
"Yes!" Hermione screeched and leapt to her feet.
"I got a newt level in History of Magic."
"So did I,"
Lupin replied calmly.
"I kind of studied it. Sometimes,"
Harry mumbled, but apparently his hag hadn't much faith in him. She was sitting down picking bugs out of her hair with a bored expression.
"Might do all right if it's relatively recent," Arthur announced cheerfully.
Elizabeth just sighed.
"It's a goblin war question,"
Teddy shrieked, and the entire wizarding crowd let out a collective moan of horror as the card whispered.
"Who led the successful raid against the vampires which led to a goblin victory in the Fourth Goblin War?"
"Oh my God, nobody remembers any of that shite he droned on about,"
Lupin snapped.
"That class was too boring for words. Even I fell asleep in it,"
Hermione moaned.
"Binns wouldn't know that," Ron groused. "He'd have to look it up."
"Glendore the Great!"
Elizabeth shrieked ecstatically, and her unicorn raced towards the finish line.
"Damn! Bloody hell! How in the world?"
Lupin just looked at her speechless.
"I've read a lot of Remus's books," Elizabeth told the group smugly. "I thought I'd learn about wizard things since I live here now, and I remember the story because I hate vampires, and Fanshawe Manor, where I grew up, is on Glendore Drive," she said triumphantly. "I was really hoping that Glendore would win. It was in 1744, and he only had 10,000 goblins against 50,000 vampires, and they chased them all the way back to Romania."
The listening crowd stared at her in stunned amazement, and George jumped up and swept off his hat with a flourishing bow.
"Nice job, Elizabeth," Ron said grudgingly, but smiled at her.
"Brilliant," Harry enthused.
"Excellent. This was your first game," Hermione called out happily. "I can't even believe it."
Well done, I say. Astonishing," Arthur enthused.
"You are amazing,"
Lupin told her proudly. Elizabeth, who had never received this much praise at once in her entire life, flushed furiously.
"Aunt Elizabeth is the smartest muggle ever,"
Teddy shrieked and began dancing around on the lawn.
"She's the smartest woman ever,"
Lupin corrected him.
"And she's hot," George grinned and winked in Elizabeth's direction. "How the hell did you ever get her? I mean, especially when she could have had Percy."
Everyone except Molly burst out laughing, and Lupin levitated his coffee over George's head, where it promptly poured itself down the front of his face.
"What the fuck do you want?"
William snapped rudely and jumped to his feet when Lupin apparated into his den.
"Quit coming here, you stupid son of a bitch! Quentin told you you're not welcome here," he added nastily.
"What Quentin doesn't know won't hurt him,"
Lupin replied calmly, although William's last sentence had stung.
"I'm not going to stop visiting you."
William went purple with rage and started sputtering.
"Will you calm down? I'm here because I bloody worry about you, and I'll keep coming until you tell me who did this to you."
"Then you'll keep coming for the rest of your bloody life," William shouted, "because I'm never going to tell you. Never!"
Lupin looked at him for a very long time, got up, paced around in circles, and turned back with tears in his eyes.
"William,"
he said tersely,
"you know I love you. The anger curse doesn't take away your memory.
I can't let you live like this. It's ruining your life and making you miserable. You've run off your girlfriend and lost your job and—
There's nothing you can do about it, you fucking asshole! William screamed triumphantly. Nothing!
That's where you're wrong, Lupin responded shortly. Don't you think I know how to get information out of people?
This actually silenced him, but only for a moment.
You're a cocksucking motherfucking pussy, he shouted. I think you've actually beaten Sirius in the swearing department, Lupin replied, but did not smile. It's got to be done.
What are you talking about? William demanded warily and backed away a bit. Lupin took out his wand.
Tell me who did this, he said sternly. Tell me who did it, or I'm going to crucio your ass. You've got my word on it.
William went quite pale, but then the familiar torrent of rage washed over him like a tidal wave.
No! He yelled. I won't, you fucker! And you won't, crucio!
William let out a scream of terror, and then of agony, and then fell to the floor, writhing in pain. Lupin turned away, quite sure he was going to be sick. 5 minutes, he told himself. 5 minutes. Every Death Eater talks after 5 minutes. It seemed more like 5 hours to both of them, and when Lupin shouted,
Finite!
His voice was shaking.
I hate you! I hate you! I hate you!
William yelled as he rolled about on the floor, drenched in sweat.
Tell me who did it,
Lupin spat out.
Tell me, or I'll do it again.
Fine then, you bloody asshole! William shouted. It was that damned skull I bought on Nocturne Ollie that put wheels on!
What? You told me you got rid of that thing. I told you that was a dark object. Since when have I ever listened to you?
William screamed back.
Where is it?
Lupin said tersely, and for a moment William assumed a recalcitrant expression. But then stomped around the room, kicked over a few chairs, and shouted,
The damn attic! I locked it up and charmed the door shut!
Lupin disapparated with a bang. William's charming spell took Lupin about 10 seconds to undo, and he pulled down the ladder to start climbing in. But apparently this skull object was quite desperate to get out, since it sailed down nearly onto his head and began wheeling frantically out of the room.
Petrificus totalus!
Lupin snapped.
Hable!
Scully was frozen in place.
You can move, but you can't talk,
Lupin said and pointed his wand at him.
Start talking. You have no idea who I am,
hissed a deep and threatening voice from within the skull.
I don't give a damn who you are,
Lupin replied impatiently.
You can't even get out of a basic locking spell,
he added spitefully.
My powers have diminished over time,
it hissed again.
Nevertheless, when you know who I am, you will feel terror like no other you have felt before.
Lupin closed his eyes and sighed.
Get on with it, then,
he replied wearily. He was so focused on the skull, he didn't notice Rosie until she burst through the door, her arms full of stacks of old clothing, apparently meant to be put in the attic.
Scully!
She shrieked delightedly and dropped the clothes.
Well, I haven't seen you in ages!
Lupin shook his head in disgust.
You know this thing?
Sure. He's been around since I was a little girl,
Rosie beamed.
He's really funny. I haven't seen him since, well, after Christmas, I guess. What are you doing up here, anyway?
This is the dark object that cursed William, Lupin snapped. Now clear off this floor.
No,
she shouted stubbornly, but stared at Scully with a rather horrified expression.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm sure. William told me, and he wasn't lying. Now get out.
What the hell is he?
She shrieked, and Lupin sighed. He should have known she would ignore his instructions.
He seems to be trying to lead up to that,
he replied dryly.
Apparently I'm meant to be quite frightened.
Rosie backed up and stood behind him, but kept peering out interestedly from behind the cloak.
I am the skull of Salazar Slytherin,
Scully screamed out triumphantly.
The greatest dark wizard who ever—
I've studied history of magic, Lupin informed Scully irritably. And I think when you put that anger curse on William, you gave away whatever power you had left.
How could somebody's skull be alive?
Rosie hissed.
He's kept his spirit embodied in his skull, Lupin told her patiently. I suppose because he isn't in a hurry to get on to the afterlife. Can't imagine why.
Reverse the curse, he snarled. Apparently Scully had given up trying to frighten him.
I can't. I haven't any powers left,
he said in a miserable voice.
You don't need any. You've already done the curse. You only need to say the reversing charm. Perhaps we'll bring your powers back as well,
Lupin added in a polite tone, and Rosie gave him a nervous look.
We don't want him to get his powers back, do we?
She yelled.
He's got to undo that curse. William's living in a nightmare. Let him keep his miserable existence,
Lupin said idly, but a greedy expression had crossed Scully's face, if one could call it that.
Angicus! Hassia Atras!
He screamed triumphantly, and a blaze of green light shot from both his eyes. A terrible chill filled the room, as if it had been submerged in ice water, and Rosie shivered with cold and fear.
I can feel it! It's back! Oh, my powers!
Scully shrieked melodramatically.
Kill it!
Rosie screamed.
I'm already dead!
Scully shouted, and the whole room lit up with a flash of green light that knocked Rosie right to the floor. Scully levitated himself about 6 feet off the ground and flew up into Lupin's face.
Prepare to die!
He screamed dramatically.
Perhaps you should have had a career in the theater,
Lupin replied irritably.
I'm always prepared to die. And quit this drama queen bit. You're giving me a headache. Don't make it mad!
Rosie wailed from the floor.
Confringo!
Lupin shouted, and Scully burst into about 14 pieces, which clattered onto the floor and then immediately reformed themselves. More green jets of light blasted from his eye sockets, and Lupin dove to the floor.
Protego!
Lupin yelled as he rolled over and sprang back up on his feet, and Rosie felt something warm and solid, though not at all visible, in front of her face. It's a shield charm, she thought to herself with relief. He's put it up in front of me.
Hagalo Fiendfire!
The Fiendfire dragon appeared and promptly swallowed Scully up whole, only to spit him back out again. Apparently, he was too vile to stomach. There was a loud bang, and Neville appeared in the room, his face very flushed and his hands and arms covered in dirt. Apparently, he'd been working in the greenhouse.
Elizabeth owled me. Your clock hand was on mortal peril, and she said you'd gone to visit William. She wanted me to flew her here.
He stammered out and looked wildly around the room at Scully.
Disembodied spirit. Already dead. Can't use a killing curse,
Lupin told him shortly as he pointed his wand at Scully.
And thank you for not bringing Elizabeth. I've already got one muggle here that won't keep herself out of danger.
Neville regarded Scully with a thoughtful expression as he zoomed about the room, shooting his green jets of light, which kept bouncing against walls and caving them in.
Gryffindors!
Scully screamed and blasted a jet at Neville, who jumped to the side as the stream of green light blew out a window.
Heirs of Godric Gryffindor, prepare to die, fools! He's a bit of a drama queen,
Lupin told Neville apologetically, and Neville shook his head in disgust. Scully, however, continued with his show.
I hope that he's watching me destroy you. He, the only one I...
He paused and stopped speaking, apparently aware he just made a fatal error. Neville and Lupin exchanged quick glances.
Ever feared, Neville finished and grinned at Lupin.
Right, the sword, Lupin responded. Accio Gryffindor sword!
The ruby-encrusted silver sword zoomed through a hole in the window, and the hilt flew straight into his hand. And he sprung forward and thrust the sword into one of Scully's eye sockets. Scully let out a shriek of agony as tremendous blasts of red and green light exploded throughout the room, like some epic battle between heaven and hell. He flew up into the air and smashed himself wildly against Lupin's face and chest, hurled himself into Neville's forehead with a horrible cracking sound, and then dropped to the ground and split into two empty and desolate pieces. Rosie knew immediately that his spirit was gone. The room was flooded with warmth.
Oh!
Neville yelled, stomped around in a circle, and then promptly toppled over to the floor with a resounding crash. Rosie burst into tears and rushed over to his side.
He's all right,
Lupin choked out. He had fallen to his knees himself, his lip and cheek bleeding and a large purplish bruise swelling up over one eye.
It's knocked him out. He'll be okay.
As predicted, Neville began stirring about and looked up at Rosie through blurred eyes.
Rosie, Remus, are you okay? Putting this oil on top shelf, don't spill it on your robes.
He instructed them firmly, and Rosie began to giggle.
Shouldn't you take him to St. Mungo's?
She demanded and glared over at Lupin.
Well, I would, he replied shortly, except I've got about 10 broken ribs here, and I don't think I can lift him. Oh, sorry. I can get myself there, and I'll send back a couple of attendants. Stay with him,
he told her sternly, and disapparated with a crack.
Don't worry, Neville,
Rosie shrieked as Neville winced and rubbed his forehead.
You're going to be okay!
Right, he mumbled. Golden Club, dueling vulture hat, Snape fellow brought him late, crazy aunt, he announced and smiled in a rather dazed and silly fashion. I'd seen you all summer.
I thought you were mad at me about my dad,
Rosie wailed, and Neville looked puzzled. The elevator doors opened, and several male servants, Henry, Jamie, and Quentin, all rushed in together.
The fuck happened up here?
Jamie shouted in a frightened tone, which was somewhat understandable, as the room had, literally, been blasted to pieces.
I think your werewolf buddy's been decorating again,
Henry smirked to Quentin, who was scowling horribly.
You okay, Rosie? Isn't my fucking friend, and he bloody well better not have been here,
Quentin spat out.
That's odd,
Rosie shouted venomously.
Henry asks me how I am, and all you're worried about is whether someone's been in your damned house,
she shrieked.
It's odd about me asking how you are, Henry said irritably.
Think I don't care about you?
Yours, Mungo's, you leaves, living dead, tag, hash, 4,200 pairs of socks,
Neville muttered and rolled over on his back.
Cracked me head.
No, I don't,
Rosie told Henry bitterly.
You got tired of me when I was like 12 years old, and I thought I had a new dad that cared about me, and he turns out to be the world's most giant asshole.
Shut the fuck up, Quentin barked out. Do you think you can say whatever you bloody well please when you're living under my roof?
Haven't much roof left, Jamie commented snidely.
This was quite true. The entire ceiling was gone, including the attic, and the bright sun shone directly in on the wreckage of the 17th floor den. I didn't get tired of you, Henry said with a surprised expression. I just didn't know what to do with you. Little kids are fine, but I don't know what the fuck to do with a moody teenage girl. Besides, I knew you were going to figure out eventually. Well, I guess it was backing off before you dumped me for your real father, he said calmly, but glanced away.
Rosie burst into tears, and Quentin stomped angrily out of the room. I don't know what to think about you, she screeched at Henry, and I can't stand him.
Garden club, smoking bag, green cat, toilet brush, didn't do it with a spell,
Neville mumbled and smiled up at the sky.
It's a nice day.
There were two cracks, and a pair of large men in long white broadcloth shirts, cotton pants, and brown smocks appeared.
Professor Longbottom, one of the men announced as they rushed over to Neville. All right, then. Here you've gotten a concussion. We'll take you to the hospital.
Sure, Neville smiled beatifically. Bring me Muggle friend. Rosie.
What the? Jamie looked towards the remnants of the doorway with a startled expression as William rushed through the door, his face streaked with tears.
Wes Remus! He shouted frantically as he surveyed the destruction. Rosie! Is he okay? Are you okay? He's fine!
Rosie jumped up and flung herself into his arms with a great feeling of relief.
It's you! You're back! It's gone!
Yeah, it's gone. I'm so sorry,
William whispered and took her hands into his.
I can't even tell you how sorry I am. I don't know what to do. I've got to apologize to everybody. I've been the world's biggest jerk.
It was just that angry curse, Jamie said in a practical voice. It wasn't really you. I mean, you've lived here for 12 years. We all know you.
We'll be off then, said one of the attendants impatiently, and Rosie realized Neville was watching her holding William's hands.
Yeah, he said and looked away. Glad you're okay, William. Come visit Remus at the hospital. I'd be really glad to see you. Back to yourself.
Thanks. Listen, I'm really sorry. I was horribly rude to you.
It's fine,
Neville mumbled as the two attendants hoisted him up and disappeared with three loud cracks.
Henry!
William appeared on the verge of another babbling apology, but Henry cut him off.
Don't mention it. I'm just glad you're back.
Might be interesting to have an intelligent conversation once in a while. He gave William a thoughtful look.
I wonder if Victor and Kenny will even notice.
He and William started laughing, but Rosie looked down at the floor with a flushed face. Now what do I do? She thought miserably. Who am I supposed to choose for my boyfriend? Jamie walked over and gave her a consoling look.
You needn't decide right away,
he said sternly. Rosie appeared quite startled by this, but Jamie just gave her a cocky grin.
Well, we are twins, you know, he said and walked out laughing.
How's that hat even get to know who I am?
Tim whispered to Alex as they sat huddled on the boat.
My last name's still Demuse, he intoned gloomily. He wasn't my father for sure. Even if my dad was a Gryffindor, it won't know what my real name is.
Sure it will,
Alex replied distractedly. Apparently he was worrying about the sorting himself. That's easy for you to say, Tim thought sullenly, when your last name's Weasley.
You don't even know who your father is,
the square-headed boy with the mean eyes called out in a mocking voice.
Is your mom some slut or something?
You shut up!
Timothy shouted furiously and leapt to his feet, and Alex and the mousy-haired boy from the train leapt up as well.
Oh, you're right, asshole!
Alex yelled.
Yeah, nobody's gonna like you at all,
the mousy-haired boy declared threateningly.
Who cares what you think?
The fellow responded nastily, and everyone else on the boat began chiming in their comments.
Why are you listening in on that conversation anyway?
One of the girls shrilled out.
He wasn't talking to you. Maybe he's got really good hearing,
a skinny girl with blonde pigtails called out and gave the square-headed boy a mocking glance.
Maybe he's a werewolf.
Everyone except Timothy laughed at this.
I'm not a werewolf,
the boy shouted wrathfully.
What the hell's wrong with you?
I've been studying magical creatures, the blonde replied in a smug voice, and werewolves have very good hearing, even when they aren't transformed.
That's true, Timothy announced and eyed her with some respect. I have a really good friend who's a werewolf, so I know.
And he's an oral,
he replied proudly.
Are you talking about Remus Lupin?
His adversary responded in a scathing tone.
My mom told me about him. If I knew a werewolf, I wouldn't even talk to it. He's not an it!
Team screamed in a blinding rage and pushed the boy, who was a head taller than himself, right into the lake.
Help!
He shrieked piteously just before his head disappeared under the water.
Help! I can't swim! I can't!
The 6-year prefect gave Timothy an enraged look and dove into the water, reappearing with the boy latched onto him in a stranglehold.
Look at my neck!
He panted as he pulled the spluttering boy into the boat.
He choked me to death! That's because he's a bloody coward,
Timothy shouted. You got 3 detentions, the prefect barked out. 2 for pushing somebody out of the boat and 1 for swearing. You're not getting started off very well, he added threateningly.
He's not even human, the boy continued as he stared at Timothy, obviously aware he'd hit a nerve. He's just a bloodthirsty beast.
Timothy promptly leapt at the boy and punched him in the nose, and the prefect dragged them apart.
Sit down, he yelled and yanked him to the opposite end of the boat. Now you've got 5 detentions, and you're going to McGonagall over this.
Timothy stared at the bottom of the boat, horrified when he realized he was fighting back tears. I'm in big trouble already, he thought with a sickening lurch in his stomach. The hat's going to put me in Slytherin for sure, because I've been so bad. A few minutes later, the mousy-haired boy made his way down to sit beside Tim.
He's the one that's going to be a Slytherin,
he whispered determinedly.
Don't worry. Gryffindors are supposed to stick up for their friends, right?
Timothy gave him a grateful and somewhat surprised look.
Thanks. What was your name?
He said sheepishly.
Melvin,
the boy replied resignedly.
Melvin Morville. It's an awful name. Well, at least you know what it is,
Tim responded gloomily, and the two of them smiled at each other. The only good thing about being a Demuse, Tim thought, was that he'd be put out of his misery quickly. There were 100 first years between himself and Alex, who sat almost at the very end of the bench.
Esther Claridge!
Professor Trelawney called out in her ethereal voice, and the girl with the blonde pigtail sprang up nervously and hurried onto the platform. Who put crazy old Sybil in charge of calling out names? Timothy thought disgustedly.
Gryffindor!
Shouted the hat, and Esther squealed delightedly and ran over to the Gryffindor table. 4 more C's and 2 D's later, Sybil mangled out the words,
Timothy Demostet!
I don't even have a name, Tim thought angrily as he stomped up to the stairs, and they can't even pronounce the name I don't have.
It's Demuse,
he hissed as he strode past Sybil, who blinked in a startled manner. Apparently, first years never spoke up during the sorting. It was a bit difficult, however, for Timothy to be intimidated by a woman that had danced with his grandfather and shown up for breakfast after shagging his older brother. Sybil looked him over, narrowed her eyes, and frowned.
I believe we have met in another life,
she intoned in a melancholy whisper.
We've met in this life,
Timothy said loudly,
at the Valentine's Ball and at the breakfast table when you shagged my brother.
6 detentions,
Sybil shrieked, and Timothy realized he had lost count of how many detentions he had, and he wasn't even sorted yet. McGonagall closed her eyes briefly, and then angrily cleared her throat.
If you please, she pronounced dourly, continue.
By this time, Timothy was so infuriated and embarrassed he just wanted the whole business over with, and he snatched up the hat and jammed it furiously down over his ears. Go ahead, he told the hat furiously. Go ahead and put me in Slytherin. I know you will. I know that stupid Malfoy was my dad, and that's why Lupin doesn't want to take me back. He probably found out.
Gryffindor!
The hat bellowed. Timothy did not move.
You may sit down now, Timothy,
McGonagall pronounced dryly from the high table, but Timothy seemed completely unable to move.
I can't,
he blurted out.
Yeah, I can't. Sorry,
he added desperately. Did I just imagine that? Did it really say that? Did it? Apparently, this sort of thing had happened before, because Hagrid appeared completely unsurprised, picked him up off the stool, and carted him over to the Gryffindor table. Everyone there was laughing, but not in a mean sort of way.
Not surprised, were you?
Grinned one of the oldest Gryffindors, a cheerful and handsome young man with curly black hair.
Hagrid had to pick me up, too. All my family were Hufflepuffs.
Timothy gave him an appreciative look and began to feel relieved. Apparently, this boy was quite popular, since the others quickly hurried to follow his lead and introduce themselves as well.
Robert Pembroke, I'm captain of the Gryffindor Quidditch team, the older boy told him proudly, and then added casually, and the Gryffindor prefect. Do you play?
Yeah,
Tim said and started smiling. I'm really a Gryffindor.
I'm really a Gryffindor, I am. I don't care that I got... How many detentions have I got? Tim glanced around at the milling crowd of boys before speaking up in what he hoped was a modest-sounding voice.
Harry Potter taught me when I stayed at his house.
When the feast arrived, Timothy decided he had never been this happy in his entire life. Alex and Melvin were Gryffindors as well, and he and Alex had exchanged a meaningful look over Melvin's head that said, "Maybe he'll be our third marauder." And everyone at the table, even Robert Pembroke, was astonished that he actually knew Harry Potter, and had even ridden on the back of his broom with him. Tim did not bother mentioning he had been bawling the entire time, or that Harry had told him twice to shut up. He had, in fact, quite forgotten about the detentions, when the looming figure of Hagrid suddenly appeared above him with a stern expression and instructions to go to McGonagall's office now. Tim gulped and scurried to keep up with him, wondering if Hagrid remembered him from either the Valentine's ball or the wedding, and decided he probably didn't, since he'd been drunk at both of them.
"Don't speak till you're spoken to," Hagrid growled as they climbed up the circular staircase. "Say yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. Don't be making no excuses or making anything up. She'll know."
"Yes, sir,"
Timothy replied promptly. He sat himself nervously on the large red chair in front of the headmaster's desk, where McGonagall frowned, but did not speak for several moments.
"So," she finally announced in an icy tone, 11 detentions, 5 before even arriving at school." "Yes, ma'am,"
Timothy stammered out.
"I do not wish to hear any excuses." No, ma'am."
"Now, Minerva," wheezed the raspy voice of Phineas Nigellus, "don't be too hard on the boy."
McGonagall appeared completely astonished at this.
"And since when do you speak up for a student, Phineas?"
she demanded sharply.
"Keep yourself quiet."
Tim managed a brief smile at Phineas, who was nodding indulgently in his direction, and then glanced at Dumbledore, who appeared decidedly sympathetic as well. Why can't any of them still be headmaster? He thought desperately.
"Never before in the history of this school," McGonagall pronounced in a deathly tone, "has a student earned detentions before they've even gotten themselves off the boat."
Timothy's heart started beating painfully. "I'm going to get kicked out," he thought frantically. "I know it. I know it."
"I believe you are forgetting, Minerva," Snape yawned from his portrait, "that Professor Lupin, of whom you and the boy are so fond, earned several detentions before getting himself into the boat."
"I'll thank you to leave the students to me, Severus,"
McGonagall said stridently, apparently tiring of interference from her portraits.
"I believe I am the current headmistress here."
"Certainly,"
Snape responded in a bored voice and strode out of his portrait. And Timothy took a deep breath and glazed resolutely at McGonagall.
I shouldn't have spoken back to Professor Trelawney, and I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry I took up for Professor Lupin. Even if you expel me, make me go back home, because he came and got me when I was stuck at Draco's, and even though I was acting like an awful brat and he almost died, and I'm never going to let anybody insult him ever."
"Well done," Dumbledore beamed. "Spoken like a true Gryffindor. Courage and loyalty."
Apparently Dumbledore was granted more leeway to speak, Tim thought, since Minerva did not correct him. "Well, at least I was a Gryffindor for an hour," Tim thought gloomily and sighed.
"And what is that sighing about?"
McGonagall demanded.
"Oh, no, you'll boot me out,"
Tim responded gloomily. McGonagall sniffed.
"I do not believe you are to blame for Sybil's inappropriate behavior in your own home. And I do not allow anything to be said against Remus Lupin myself. The detentions are dismissed. You may go back to your house."
Timothy stared at her.
"Are you never able to get up from a chair?" Minerva barked out. "I would like to retire sometime before midnight, young man." "Yes, ma'am,"
Timothy blurted out quickly.
"Thank you, ma'am, thanks. I was just wondering if I could keep a few of the detentions, ma'am."
McGonagall looked as flabbergasted as if Tim had begged her to throw him out of the window.
"Keep the detentions!" she shrilled.
And for a moment, Tim imagined he heard someone laughing behind Phineas Nigellus's portrait.
"Yes, ma'am," he continued earnestly. "I'm trying to be an honorary marauder, like George Weasley and Professor Lupin and Sirius Bl-" "I know who the marauders are,"
McGonagall practically shouted.
"And I am not going through that again. I am an old woman," she muttered fiercely.
Timothy may not have known who his actual father was, but he had grown up around Henry.
"You don't look like an old woman," he said earnestly.
"Do not give me that innocent routine," McGonagall fumed as she began slamming files around on her desk. "You've been around that boy entirely too much. Off to bed with you, young man." Timothy was quite puzzled as to who this boy might be. "And I suppose you may keep 3 detentions," she added grudgingly.
"Thank you, ma'am,"
Tim replied fervently and leapt out of his chair, and McGonagall just shook her head sadly. Room and bed assignments, Timothy discovered, were made by a gilded cup shaped like a lion into which the prefect poured some red powder and recited something that sounded solemn and profound in Latin. The students then pulled a slip of parchment from the cup with their room, each named for a former headmaster, and bed listed, the bed simply numbered 1 through 5.
"Godric Gryffindor's open this year," Robert announced significantly. "Anybody gets in that room always ends up being somebody important, and a bed keeps all the secrets of everyone who has had it before. If you can find them out," he added importantly, and the first years all looked impressed. Tim just wanted to be with Alex and Melvin.
"Gryffindor too!"
Alex screeched ecstatically. He had been the first to get to the cup.
"That was my cousin Fred's bed! I knew it!"
Tim didn't bother looking at the bed number once he saw Gryffindor, and neither did Melvin, although the boys were pleased to discover they were in 1, 2, and 3. 4 was assigned to a friendly Irish boy named Dugan, and the name of the boy in 5 was yet to be discovered, since he immediately crawled beneath his covers and fell asleep. The other 4 were too excited to sleep, and sat on Dugan's bed whispering excitedly until after midnight. When they went off to their own beds, Tim undressed quickly and climbed beneath his eiderdown quilt, gazing thoughtfully at his headboard. Suddenly inspired, he took his wand from the bedside dresser and tapped it.
"I solemnly swear I'm up to no good,"
he whispered. It was a good thing George had shown him those scrolls, he thought later, since he instantly recognized the handwriting that inscribed itself across the board, and knew just who had also shared this bed.
"Welcome home, Tim."